Microphone on, and we're not sure if it's dangerous or not to our ears. But Brother Verl says it looks like a spider egg on my beard. So I'm not sure I like it. It's the new trend, and we're grateful for new technology, but I'm going to speak softly until they get the adjustment. Yes, sir.
White Sentra out here on this end of the parking lot with the lights.
Okay.
Flashing.
White Sentra, if it's yours, it's flashing lights out there. White Sentra. That would be yours.
Turn signal?
Yeah. Freddie's gone. Okay, no big deal. Okay, thank you very much. All right, no problem. Good morning to you. Welcome to Bible Study Hour. So glad you're here. John chapter 15 is where we're at, the first 8 verses, or actually first 17 verses. And I'd like to identify the person that prayed for us to skip straight from late summer to winter. If we could find that person, what happened? I love it because all the babies showed up to church today with all these really beautiful hats. Have you seen that? We have got to get ourselves a nice hat like that, you know. Just to celebrate the arrival of winter, which happened last night. We woke up to 38 degrees, and where's another log to put on the fire? What fire? The one that we haven't had since February. So, welcome to this new day, and hope you are blessed. Glad to have you. And we're continuing the study of John. And I'm looking for somebody to cover for me next Sunday. Brother Melvin's gone today, isn't he? He's here. All right, I'll ask him or ask Brother Scott next Sunday. Kim and I will be gone to Nashville, so. John was inspired by God to write what he did. I have no doubts about that, and that should be number one always. As we open up the text of John 15 to remind us of that. This is God speaking through men, protected from error. That's the definition. God didn't dictate it, didn't dictate the words. John got to speak it through his words. And there's a degree to which I think that each gospel writer got to, in a sense, emphasize and choose what they wanted to put in and leave out to a degree. But protected from God. But if it is true that John is written 60 years after the events, then I'd like to bring the human side in as you and I drop into John 15 today again and remember the human side, which is, wow, do you remember anything anybody said 60 years ago? Are you kidding me? Okay, I'm at that age. No, that would make me like one, all right, by my age. But some of you are a little older than I. Watch out, I just said a little. Do you remember anything anybody said 60 years ago? Well, here's the... What's that? Okay, Brother Burl.
Not just the gist of what was said,
yeah.
But the precise words that were said. Yeah.
So we put inspiration out there first, right? But... then I'd just like to for you to consider as you drop in. I don't know if you were reading it today. I don't know if you were. I was, so I've been in it. But 60 years later, he is put in 5 chapters, what we call 5 chapters, you know, the final instructions of Jesus before departure. Departure being the cross, by the way, on the next day. Final instructions. And he remembers. Now, I know. Inspiration. I started with that, but what I'm saying is, still, from the human perspective, which God leaves in each of the apostles, the human perspective is still there. They're not just mindless microphones for God. They are spokesmen for God. They're protected from error, but that said, 60 years ago, John remembers those final hours before the cross. Wow. And he gives us more than any of the other. Matthew, Mark, or Luke. See, Matthew, Mark, or Luke, I think, were written 30 years after, 35. But John is written 60 years after the events, and it's just, it's staggering to me the how precious it is that we have these instructions. So we thank God, we thank the Holy Spirit, we thank John for giving us these instructions. So we are in John chapter 15. We already covered from verse 18 to the end last time. They will hate you. That's what we talked last time. I begged your forgiveness and have kind of reversed John 15 to treat that those teachings of Jesus. I'd like you to pick up about right here. I am the vine, and ye are the branches. That means something to you, I'm sure, but maybe not as much as it does to a gardener, to somebody that has done it for a lifetime. Do you have a green thumb? In general, I would say, no, I don't. I kill everything that comes in contact with my thumbs, but I'm getting better, starting to care, you know. Are you a green thumb? I moved to my family worked in Italy in 1984. That's a long time ago. And the institution I was working for asked me to buy a 16th century villa called Villa del Palazzaccio. And it was from a count, Count Adorni Bracisi, you know, true nobility. Those kind of people still exist, people with blue bloods, I guess you could. His brother had been a diplomat, and he was a count, and he sold the villa so we could start a study abroad for a Christian university. Along with the 16th century villa came a human being. I had never bought a human being before, and I don't think it's legal in our time. I think slavery has been out for quite a while. But when we purchased the 16th century villa, he mentioned that Antonio came with the land. A man came with the land. I said, I don't think we've done that since the Middle Ages. I don't think that's legal. And Antonio had been living on the land since his birth, and he came. And the years that passed with me and him working together, because I needed him, I didn't know how to take care of 500 olive trees or vineyards. I had no clue. I was going to kill everything if I'd been in charge of it, but he knew how. He had done it all his life. And what he'd done it all his life on an incline, too. Those of you that are finding walking or standing a little more problematic than it was when you were young, Antonio was older than I, and he walked like this because he had been doing vineyards and olive groves on an incline for all his life. So one of his hips was worn out, and so he walked like this a bit. I'm exaggerating a bit, but not much. He had to have double hip replacements toward the end of his life. I begged him to get it done earlier, but he had absolute distrust of federal government, of Italy, and of doctors, both of those. He knew the land, and he knew olive groves, and he knew vineyards. He knew how those worked, and he knew what had to be done. So I learned to appreciate John 15, verses 1 through 8, through Antonio a lot more, because he showed me not only the love, the care, the passion for a vineyard that you have to have. Of course, in the landscape of Palestine, the first century AD, vineyards and mustard trees, and let's think of all the illustrations that Jesus uses that come from farming, right? There are dozens of them, literally. But here's one. I am the vine, and you are the branches. So there it is. In the final instructions of Jesus to absolutely discombobulated, I think that's a word, right? This something. The apostles are frazzled, lost. What is he saying? Final instructions before departure, and they don't understand. He's told them repeatedly how it's going to happen, but they still don't listen because what do you mean that's going to, what do you mean it's going to end? What do you mean? What, Judas has betrayed us? We saw that last time, the absolute loss. Where's Judas going? And they're frazzled, and these are the instructions that he gives right then. So here it is. John chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. You have the ESV translation in front of you. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers, and the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. Jesus uses, as the master teacher that he is, metaphors, riddles sometimes. He uses similes. He uses all kinds of rhetorical devices. Parables are his most used technique, besides from telling it straight like it is, using a parable, and all parables about the kingdom of heaven. This is not a parable, as best I can tell, but it is a repeated image that he puts in front of a group of men, some of which have been fishermen all their lives, a tax collector. I don't know what all the rest of them did originally, but they were 90% of the world at that time were farmers, and everybody knew the farming illustrations because of where they grew up, where they came from. So they understood vine. So I am the vine, and you are the branches. It seems to me there's two aspects there. And then there's that pruning thing that I really don't like. But I've seen it. I've seen it because Antonio taught it to me. The value of pruning. So maybe I could suggest to you in your comments now, how have you read this? How do you take this? How do you make this meaningful? From 20 centuries later, as John records it for you and I, as he remembers as part of the instructions before the departure of Jesus to the cross, I am the vine and you are the branches. Stick with me. Abide in me. And then that pruning thing. What is it that you have gotten out of it, okay? This is the final of the seven I Ams. We have left for Scott when he takes over in December some favorite cherries on top of John. So if you're staying in this class, you'll go back to John 10, John 12. I've left some things for him to do and to finish the course, take you to the end of John. But this is the final of the seven I Ams. John tells the story of the gospel of Jesus in his own peculiar way, in a sense. He leaves some things out. He puts a bunch of wonderful things in. And one of the things he does is remember, put in a list the I Ams, the definitions of Jesus of himself. I am the good shepherd. You'll see that in John chapter 10 when Scott takes you back there. This is an allegory. And it's not that he just uses it once in these verses, 1 through 8. He uses it repeatedly. And this is how John records it. Who knows if Jesus didn't actually say it even more than that, but he uses it repeatedly, okay? This is an allegory of the relationship. The vine, the branches, the one who prunes it, the vine dresser. It's an allegory of the relationships between followers of Christ, the vertical, and the horizontal, okay? It's a both, but it's an allegory between the Father and the Son and the disciples and the Son. And of course, as all of Jesus' metaphors are, they're direct, they're simple. They're not complex. They don't have multiple layers. If you want to understand, you understand it immediately. The Father is the vine dresser. Jesus is the vine. And we are the branches. We are the branches. What does that mean? What did he intend for the smart, intelligent, perceptive apostles and you and I to understand out of that? What did he want us to get out of it? Okay? I put some suggestions there, but please chime in. What does this mean to you? All I know is that when I saw the allegory played out in real life with Antonio every year, when the picking of the grapes would happen in the month of October, and then there was the pruning that came along, and I saw his labor as the vine dresser. I began to understand this allegory a little better than I had before. It started meaning something to me. It stresses the importance of you and I on this final Sunday of October of the year 2017 to be connected with the vine. I mean, that's what we're called to do. So again, what does that mean? You are to reconnect with the vine. There's no life without the vine. You can't do without the vine. This is not an independent thing that we're doing here. The vine can't live without the branches can't live without the vine. You got to stay connected. So you're looking for connection. So wake up this morning and we're looking for a connection to the vine because we are the branches and we can't live without it. And here's another factor in the allegory. Fruitless branches are cut off. Fruitless branches are cut off. We cannot become fruitless branches. We get cut off. Yes, sir.
I'm one of the unfortunate that grows grapes.
Okay.
So I learned a long time ago how to do this. When he says cut off, he means exactly that. You go all the way back to the trunk of the grapevine and you cut that entire branch off. You don't ever prune a vine to take off good branches. Good branches are only branches that bear fruit. And they only bear every 2 years. So you must not cut off branches that just didn't bear this year. You cut off branches that have never bore. That's 2 years in a row. That's not forever. They don't get that choice.
So, we're not here to maintain church buildings. Is that right? We already know that, but can I say that?
Yes.
We're not here to maintain church buildings. What are we here for? What are we here for? Cannot afford to be a fruitless branch. Cannot afford to do that. I don't like that pruning part. I don't like it. Because it's personal. If you are not doing something for God, if you're not active in whatever form or fashion you can, what does Jesus say? And that's got to, we do what we do out of love for Christ, right? He died for us, so we serve Christ out of love. That's the first and prime motivator. However, there's also another factor here that Jesus adds in. He's telling the apostles, you got to stick it to the vine, otherwise you will become, well, you'll be cut off. The blessings of God will not be had. You'll be thrown into the fire because I saw Antonio do it. That which was not fruitful anymore. I love that seven times in this particular eight-verse text, it has abide in me. And of course, as soon as I heard that, you know, I love hymns, but some of you do. That beautiful, abide in me. I think it has like five verses. Sometimes we skip two of them. Abide in me. Beautiful hymn maker. Look, abide in me. It's from this text here. This is where the concept comes from. Stick with me. Make sure you're plugged into me. Abide in me. Abide with me. Whatever preposition you want to use there, abide. Abide, live, dwell. And so on this day, again, it compels us to ask ourselves, how am I going to plug back into Jesus and abide in him today and be with whatever energies I have involved in work. Abide in being fruitful as much as I can, okay? Any other comments of yours on these verses here? I am the vine and you are the branches. Surely I didn't say everything. Yes, sir.
One of the things that he mentions about being fruitful is that if you abide in him, he will make you to be more fruitful, abundant. So I think if we just look at our own lives, you know, we have to kind of ebb and flow in terms of our productivity and our service to the Lord. Usually when you see likely it's because you're not abiding. You should. It's likely because you're distracted in some way and you're focusing on something else. It says you'll be more fruitful, you'll be abundantly fruitful.
If you're plugged in. So is there a relationship between our fruitfulness and our being abiding in Him? And you're saying the text seems to say there's a direct correlation between that. So if we're having a low point in our fruitfulness to God, it could be that it's because of health or finances or family difficulties or whatever. But that said, beyond those factors, if we're having an ebb, we're in a low spot, could it be that it's because we're not as plugged in to Him, we're not connected to Him in our personal study, in our worship? I mean, we may show up to open the Bible, we may show up to a worship service. The question is, what are we bringing, what are we doing? If we're not plugged in, expecting to grow, expecting to learn, expecting to be better followers, disciples of Christ on this particular day, right? Thank you.
There's a personal application which you made. But I just think if you look at the church as a whole, that still is true. Like, most people realize that the church generally isn't growing as it used to, isn't moving out as it used to, and is much more insular. And this is all related to that. We get distracted by all these other things, and we take our focus off of the first thing, which is Christ, and we just become less profitable.
Less profitable, insular, looking at ourselves, quit looking outside. I'm glad we can bring this subject up today, because we are starting a new work today, this afternoon at 2:30. Hope you'll come to the Capitol Heights. It's not about the building, but it's about utilizing a building, new ministry, Spanish ministry, 2:30 today. We're looking outside of ourselves. Got to do that. Got to do that, okay? So we can talk about that. How more can we be mission-minded, which is what we're about, not just local, but international as well. So the Missions Committee is going to start giving 2 to 3 minutes updates on what you are involved with, these your contributions, and this the leadership of this congregation. We're trying not to be insular, not to be, and to constantly challenging ourselves to be branches that are connected to the vine, because we're supposed to be obvious good fruits are supposed to be coming from it. Now, the times will determine whether people accept it or not. Of course, these are hard times. Skepticism, secularism, relativism, and all the isms in the world are part of the reasons why a lot of people are not interested in the message. But that still doesn't relieve us of the responsibility and the need to, okay, what are we doing today? What are we doing personally and as a body? Viral, you had a comment. I hope you haven't forgotten it.
Nothing is dependent to that wasted vine. It will not produce better or more grapes. It will produce nothing out there, because its energy will be expended in this wasteful production. And that's part of what that analogy is about.
So if we take the analogy of Jesus, which you used repeatedly here, fully, there is a sense in which those of us who don't produce good fruit are a drain on the vine. Is that correct? Is that what you said? So what you just said is Terry cannot just sit on the pew.
No, I'm afraid not.
Rats. Yes.
Same with the blueberry bush. We call them suckers.
Yeah.
They grow up canes.
They take up the energy.
But they take the vital sap, suck it out of the tree or the bush, but they do nothing.
I wish I had a report of how that played out in the first century early church, you know. What do they do? What do the apostles do with this allegory? Did they put this one in their preaching lessons for the next 30 years as they lived out, you know? How'd they apply it? Yes. The Apostle Paul, of course, the most present in the New Testament writings, will live out the rest of his life showing not only his desire to go, but also to constantly be in touch. The church is his passion, his love. He's consumed by it. Yes, every day. If you want an example of apostolic, I got this lesson connected to Jesus. That would be Paul, but of course Peter too. I'm not eliminating. Paul wasn't here to hear these words, but you know, when he was converted in 34, he went and spent 15 days with the Apostle Peter. And I have joked before, can you imagine that conversation? And are you kidding me? 15 days? Peter must have said at the end, okay, that's enough, all right? These fireside chats that we've been having. But Paul is updated with, and then he said, I am the vine, and you are the branches. And the Father is the vine dresser. And so Paul got it there and went from there. So, any other comments? All right, love. Let me see what verses I'm going to read. Yes, the necessity of love. Look at 9 through 17. Let's read these verses. We're still in 15. As the Father has loved you, loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask Father in my name, he may give it to you. These things I command you so that you will love one another. This is chapter 15, of course, the example of love. First, it shows it. It's been showing it for 3 years, but first it shows it. That's the washing of the feet. And then he gives the illustration. Jesus, it's important that we understand that we follow a Lord that didn't just say things. He's the one that did it and showed it and came down to earth and applied it. So that's why he has the right to be heard. He showed us how to do this, how to do love. He showed us completely. The most staggering example being this phrase on the cross. Forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing. Okay. You show it first. Before you speak a truth, people should see it in you. Before you talk about love, people should know that you're a loving person. So this is going to just be a nice, fluffy speech about love, except that he has shown it before. I didn't treat you like servants. I treated you like friends. You're not below me, even though he's God. He says, we're on the same level. I've become man like you. He humbled himself to the point of becoming a man. And then the ultimate, lay down his life the next day, Friday. This is Thursday night. The next day, I'm going to show you love. I'm going to show you love. So in the Gospel of John, the way that John narrates it, love only appears 6 times in the first 12 chapters. But once the final instructions of Jesus in those final hours before the cross starts, chapters 13 through 17, it happens 31 times. Now, this is not an accident. This is obviously intentional. It's what's on John's heart. He remembers the words of love, the images of love, the stories, the narratives of love. It just comes all to fruition, especially in those last hours before Jesus goes to the cross. And this is obvious. This is not sentimental feelings. It's not feelings. Feelings would say, run from the cross. Feelings would say, I don't want to do this. But true passions that transcend the hard days, that are there for the hard days, the difficult days. That's what he's talking about. The real kind of love that transcends the very difficult days and goes beyond. Any comments on these verses? Anything else you want to add? There's much more, but I'd like to make sure I always give you an opportunity to say what it means to you, what these verses mean to you. Anybody on these verses here? All right. Chapter 16. Let's start there. And again, let me not hurry you, but let me see if I can get this. Well, there we go. Sorry, the technology is giving me fits for some reason. John chapter 16, I carried you through to verse 4 of actually John chapter 15 when we read the verses on persecution, the latter part of the chapter on persecution and Jesus trying to warn them that harder times are coming in the decades that they will live out as apostles of Jesus, and the persecution of Jews first and then of Roman authorities as well. So John 16, verse, beginning with verse 5 is where we're going to pick up now. And begin there. And the major theme maybe of this chapter would be that in me you may have peace. And I love this one again. Remember the difficulty. Apostles are confused and bewildered. Surely you can recall times in your life, maybe presently, when because of events, because of health, because of various political situations, environment around us, family, we are confused and bewildered. Maybe it's the church sometimes that does that to us as well. So, in an epic poem that I teach on the university level by a pagan poet by the name of Homer, that has been around for about, 28 centuries, in the Iliad there is what the poet describes as the simple life, one of the options to how you can view life. Seems like there's a lot of war, a lot of violence, a lot of animosity, hatred, nuclear threats, and internal dissension within our own culture about values, about so many things. And you yearn sometimes for just to find a neighborhood, a corner of the world where there's just peace, where there isn't any of that, where there's no need for a crime section, where the news doesn't have to talk about who was shot last night in what neighborhood. Homer, who's a pagan poet, lives in a warlike society, envisions a desire of human beings back in the 13th century before Christ among Mycenaean warriors, Greek warriors, that they yearn for peace. Just, could you give me the address, please? Because I want to move there. I want to go there. I want to live there. I don't want to wake up every morning and find out who got robbed, when, and where. I'd like for the news all to be positive, all to be good, okay? The kind of text that John 16 is, the words that Jesus speaks on this Thursday evening before Friday morning and the cross have to do with, when you're confused and bewildered, this is a text from the Son of God that is to help you believe in and yearn for and somehow find here on earth within our violent context the place where a simple life can be found. Because poet Homer has no idea where it is. But Jesus says to the apostles right before the critical day, the juncture in all of human history where the cross and the Son of God are going to be on it, the blackest moment of all of time, human history, he says, you're going to be even more bewildered and confused tomorrow morning. And this is the advice that he gives when it comes to that. Chapter 16 of John is tough. It's kind of fragmented. I'm not sure I can do it justice. And it feels like sometimes like, oh, here's another biblical image, not from a pagan poet, but you remember the image in Genesis chapter 32 of Jacob wrestling with God? You remember that one without turning those verses? So I hope that you have to wrestle with these verses as much as I did in trying to kind of how to best extract them, make these useful for our needs today. This is a text. These instructions contained in John 16 are a text that I invite you to wrestle with because they resist simplification. They resist being organized by me. And they resist being reduced to just pithy little, you know, two-word things. They are too deep, too wide, and too relevant for our time. So let's start. Verse 5 through 15. I did not say these things, Jesus says, to you from the beginning because I was with you. But now I'm going to him who sent me. And none of you asks me, where are you going? But because I have said these things to you, sorrow has filled your hearts. Nevertheless, I tell you the truth, it is to your advantage that I go away. For if I do not go away, the Helper will not come to you. But if I go, I will send him to you. When he comes, he will convict the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. Concerning sin, because they do not believe in me. Concerning righteousness, because I go to the Father, and you will see me no longer. Concerning judgment, because the ruler of this world is judged. I still have many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them right now. When the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all the truth. He will not speak on his own authority, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will declare to you the things that are to come. He will glorify me, for he will take what is mine and declare it to you. All that the Father has is mine. Therefore, I said that he will take what is mine and declare it to you. I found something new in these verses. Maybe you already knew it. But did he really say that? Did he say, the Holy Spirit can't come unless I go? Did he say that? I didn't know. I discovered that this weekend. What? It was always there. I just, you know, had not stopped to consider. The Holy Spirit can't come unless I go. He's my replacement. So the word in Greek is parakletos. It's translated Holy Spirit. It's translated, let's see, what other words can I use for comforter, advocate, counselor? These are all words that various translations use in various texts when the Holy Spirit comes up. The actual meaning of parakletos up at the top of the slide, please. One who comes alongside to help. That's all one Greek word, and it's like seven in English. So parakletos, that's what it means there. So he said, unless I go tomorrow morning, he can't come. And of course, he's meaning not just tomorrow morning, but also after he's resurrected, 40 days, and then he says to the apostles, don't leave Jerusalem because something's going to happen. And what it's going to happen is Parakletos is going to come. And he's going to be my substitute, my replacement down here, okay? Only by his going could the Helper come. That's always been there. Yep, that's what it is. So I love the fact that John is so up front with the importance of I'm not leaving you alone. Jesus says to scared apostles, I'm not leaving you alone. I will leave a replacement, substitute teacher, so to speak. I hope I'm not demeaning the Holy Spirit. Luke writes his gospel, and then he writes his account of the first 32 years of the church, book of Acts, And the Holy Spirit is all through it. And as you know, the title, the Book of Acts of the Apostles, is one of the many titles we could give to it. The original text doesn't have a title. What we might more likely give it is the Acts of the Holy Spirit. Because Jesus ascends into heaven, Acts chapter 1, and the rest of the book of Acts, 27 chapters, is about the actions of the replacement of Jesus, Holy Spirit, through men, the apostles, right? Acts chapter 2, Holy Spirit comes in on the 12 in the upper room, and they are gifted with the gifts of the Holy Spirit. Moving on. Acts chapter 5, couple lies to the Holy Spirit, and we learn that you don't do that. You don't do that. Acts chapter 6, 7 men are appointed, and the Holy Spirit, one of the charismatic gifts is given to them. Stephen stands out in his use of truth and his gift, and he dies in chapter 7. Chapter 8, Holy Spirit works through Philip. And chapter 9, Jesus is there all through the book of Acts. Like, for example, he's the one that appears to Paul on the road of Damascus, Acts chapter 9. But the Holy Spirit is like the thread that holds together the whole book of Acts. That makes it make sense. That's what he was saying. He was saying, I'm not leaving you alone. And you and I have evidence from the book of Acts, as Luke narrated, of the importance of the comforter, the parakletos, the one who kept it all together. Okay, now today, of course, it's not that we're uncomfortable. We've done a study on the Holy Spirit here, and we believe in the Holy Spirit. I teach the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. On the other hand, of course, we have some of our friends that believe in the actions of the Holy Spirit as still playing out like they did in the first century with charismatic gifts. And of course, that is confusing. So you have, one side accusing another side of Christianity that we're stuffing the Holy Spirit. We're not letting that Holy Spirit act if we don't believe in modern-day charismatic gifts. On the other hand, we might understand, as my understanding is, the charismatic gifts were there for the first century to jumpstart the church, to make sure that you and I had the New Testament, and that the access to the Holy Spirit that you and I have now is through the words that we have. And however, the Holy Spirit still acts through the words. And the less we're plugged in to the words, to the teachings, the less that the Holy Spirit can work through us. But we're not alone. Correct me if I'm wrong. Say something, okay? What do you think?
All anybody knows about the Holy Spirit is what the Bible teaches.
Correct. There are no new revelations. Correct. And that's why I put there things that we know. True. Right. Okay. All truth today is to be evaluated in the light of what the apostles were given through the Holy Spirit. Anything new, any new revelation that we have today that is said to be a new revelation is to be evaluated by that which was given by the Holy Spirit to the apostles. If it's an addition, then it can't be the Holy Spirit. It's something else, but it's not the Holy Spirit. Yes?
When you began this lesson, you asked the question, how many of us could remember
60 years ago?
And all of us agreed we could not.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I was trying to say. You said it better than what I said. All truth, any revelation, anything, if it doesn't match up, doesn't jive, doesn't follow the teachings of the apostles, then it's not from the Holy Spirit. It's that simple. And no, I don't think that Holy Spirit acts with the charismatic gifts that it did in the first century. We are told in Ephesians chapter 4 that it were there as a gift for the church in the starting up days. On the other hand, the Holy Spirit still acts through the Word, still acts. And so we must stay connected to the Word, not tradition, not anything else, the Word, the Bible. That's our standard right there. Any other comments? Yes. So does the Holy Spirit. In case you didn't hear, the Holy Spirit doesn't do his own thing. The Holy Spirit is there, like us, to serve the vine. Correct. Okay, good. Thank you for your attention today and your thoughts.